Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are a little short of a quorum, but we are past our appointed time. We're going to hear three bills this morning that will be laid over for possible inclusion. The first is presented to us by Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, would you like to go ahead?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Yes, I'd like to introduce House File 2395. It has to do with the expanding, or at least looking at the more use of something that's done real well for the DNR, and that's the use of a general permit. And with me this morning is Dale Holmuth of the DNR to further explain the bill for the committee.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mr. Holmuth, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dale Holmuth, I'm the manager of the Conservation Assistance and Regulations section of the DNR, and This bill is a way of getting permit streamlining that the legislature and governor have indicated that they want agencies to do. We're proposing a bill that will expand the number of types of permits we can use general permits for, including programs like water appropriation permits, aquatic plant management permits, aeration system permits, threatened and endangered species taking permits, and our longer-term plan is to develop a online permitting system, which is under development right now. First phase should be done in a little over a year, and I envision a system where people could apply for permits, and if they apply to do something that is covered by a general permit, they could literally print out their permit approval online. So that's what we're trying to set up to be able to do with this proposed bill. A quick walk through Section 1 would amend Minnesota Statutes Section 84.0895, Subdivision 7. And this statute prohibits the taking of wild and threatened plants and animals without a permit. The proposed changes to this section would allow the DNR to use general permits to cover broad categories of activities, and there are occasionally certain takings issues where it's just considered a formality, and if we could include these as a general permit, it would reduce paperwork for both the DNR and the public. Section 2 amends Minnesota Statute Section 97A.401, and this is the requirement in statute for special permits for taking of wild animals. Things like specimen collection, transporting wild animals for rehabilitation, taking wild animals from state parks, removing wild animals that are damaging private property, breeding and selling raptors, hawks, eagles. Those all require permits. As you can tell by the subject there, we envision there's a number of types of categories. A general permit to the university to have a collection of stuffed raptors, that sort of thing, could be covered by a general permit. This would all save both the state and the public considerable effort in processing paperwork. And then Sections 3 and 4 of the proposed bill would amend Minnesota Statutes Section 103G.245 and 271, which relate to public water work permits and water appropriation permits. Right now, the statutes have existed for over a decade. We've used those very successfully, but they do contain a provision that says we can only use general permits for minimal impact activities. And there is concern right now. We have a proposed general permit that would cover basically all bridge and culvert installation in the state, both public and private. If you install culverts or bridges in a certain way, following certain conditions, you would get pretty much automatic approval. And there is concern that the minimal impact restriction of the statute could cause difficulties. If somebody contested that, this would remove that difficulty. I would note that both rules for both permit programs already contain requirements that that any permit we issue have minimal impact on natural resources, so it's an unnecessary requirement in our opinion. Section 5 of the proposed bill would amend Minnesota Statute Section 103G.301, and what this proposed amendment would do would be to establish a fee system to replace the permit application fee system we have now. Right now, we have to require a fee between $150 and $1,000 for any work in beds, a public waters permit. There's concern that as we expand the number of general permits, there'll be reduced revenues to the water management account. Therefore, we're proposing a $100 processing fee for each approval under a general permit. We estimate we take in roughly $200,000 a year in permit application fees. And if we were able to cut the number of individual permits we issue by half, the state would lose about $100,000 a year in permit revenue. With this $100 processing fee, it would bring at least $40,000 of that back into the account. There's still $60,000 in lost revenue estimated, but the savings in staff time and the ability to focus on more important permits would be worth it, we feel. Also, just a side note, where one of the provisions would make it clear that a permit application fee is not required for the general permit itself. Right now, this causes some administrative difficulty for us. Section 6 would amend 103G.301, which we're adding these notification fees to the types of projects. Right now, the law says you can't refund a permit application fee if somebody decides to later not do a project. This would say the same thing for the project notification fees. The reason being the cost, the work involved for us to process an application or a notification is the same whether or not they actually do the project. Section 7 of amends 103G.301 subdivision 5 and also clarifies that state and federal agencies are also exempt from the project notification fee as they are currently exempt from permit application fees. Section 8 would amend 103G.301 subdivision 5A, which limits township permit application fees to $100. And makes it clear that the same thing would apply to these project notifications. Section 9 would amend Minnesota Statute Section 103G.611, which would allow the possibility of using a general permit for aeration systems. These are the bubbler systems that keep water open to keep fish alive or to keep docks, dams from freezing up tight against them. Right now we issue a little surprisingly over 300 of these a year, and there's a $250 fee for processing them. We see a potential issuing a general permit for certain types of these that would greatly reduce the staff time, and we're asking that there be a $100 fee required to utilize a general permit for an aeration system. That would result in a loss of about $30,000 in revenue to the water management account, but we feel that would easily be made up for in the savings of staff time and could be easily absorbed. And finally, Section 10 amends Minnesota Statute Section 103G.615. And this would allow the possible use of general permits for aquatic plant management permitting. And there are over 4,000 aquatic plant management permits issued each year. And we've discovered that something like 3,000 of these are simply renewals, same project, same location. And we think that a general permit covering these kind of things could be easily set up. And then we're asking that also would amend 103G615 subdivision 2, which right now there's a $35 fee for a aquatic plant management permit, and we're asking for a $30 fee if we can utilize a general permit and cover these same activities. That would be a slight loss of income, but the reduced staff time, paper processing should easily pay for itself. And I believe I've covered the entire bill with that.
Thank you, Mr. Holmuth. I believe we have a quorum present. We'll officially call this meeting to order, and we're ready for questions regarding this bill. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the desire to be more efficient, and particularly with things that are very routine. But I have major questions about sections 3 and 4, where you are removing the minimal impact upon public waters. And I have two concerns here. One, you said that we're just taking the minimal impact out of statute but leaving it in rule, so it will be okay. If you take it out of statute, you have no basis for your rule, so somebody can sue you and say your rule you can't use your rule, and they would be correct. So your reasoning to us is not right. But more importantly, I have been involved in one of these minimal impact things that DNR issued, probably without authority, years ago when the airport was building a tunnel under one of its runways for trucks to go under the runway. And it was one of these just general permits, you can do anything you want, so there was some dewatering going on. Well, the dewatering that was going on turned out would have lowered the level of the lake in my district, Lake Nokomis, and probably a lot of people know about Lake Nokomis. But DNR didn't know enough to know enough about the impact. So there was a major lawsuit. Lots of people spent a huge amount of time because DNR had issued a general permit not knowing where water was flowing underground. And since we don't know where water is flowing underground in a lot of areas in this state, this seems to me to be just a huge red flag of danger for just inviting lawsuits. So instead of being efficient, it's just the opposite. And I don't think we want to be in the business of setting up major problems in an efficiency bill. So at some point, Mr. Chairman, I would like to make an amendment to remove these two sections.
Mr. Holmuth, would you care to make a response?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the circumstance you're talking about, the airport, I'm very, very familiar with. My opinion is that it wouldn't have made any difference whether there was a general permit or an individual permit in that case. The Metropolitan Airports Commission had a general permit that required them to notify us before they started any dewatering work, and they failed to do so. The same thing would have happened if there was an individual, if there hadn't been a general permit, they would have failed to apply for the dewatering permit to start with. So I don't think it would have made any difference. And that's the same with all general, most general permits require the person doing the work to notify us. There's still a simple form they have to fill out. There's a chance to say, wait a minute, we don't know what's going on here. You can't use this general permit. So I don't see that the protection is any less. What it does avoid is a 30-day review by local governments. All the pre-reviews get done when you issue a general permit. The, the county soil and water conservation districts, the watershed districts, the other department divisions get a chance to talk about the conditions. And once everybody agrees to under what conditions you can do this work, then a general permit is issued, providing that anybody doing work like that does it in that way. If they don't, then they need an individual permit just like they would without a general permit.
Representative Guinness.
And why are you removing the minimal impact language? Because now you're saying you could have maximum impact on water. This doesn't, it's not making sense to me.
Mr. Holmuth.
The concern.
Mr. Holmuth, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The concern is that on the face of it, if we issue a permit for, well, we have issued permits for construction dewatering. If you dewater less than 50 million gallons a year, you can be covered under this general permit. On its face, 50 million gallons could be more than a minimal impact in some locations. Our concern is that somebody's going to point that out in the court of law at some date and say, this general permit doesn't comply with the statute because on its face, it could cause more than minimal impact, even though in actuality it won't because the conditions prevent the minimal impact. So it's more of a, I'm classifying it more as a cleanup of the statute to avoid future lawsuits.
Thank you. Any other questions this morning? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holmuth, and I came in a little late, so I may have missed it, but why are we doing this? Is it because we just don't have the staff at the agency anymore? We don't have the funds, or what's the rationale behind the bill?
It's as I said at the outset before you arrived. It's to further the streamlining that the governor has requested through his executive order and the legislature through House File 1 of last year. It's also to streamline so that we can better concentrate on more important reviews. Our staff spend a lot of time just pushing paper. And that's why we started using general permits for some activities a number of years ago. I remember as a field hydrologist processing 60 or 70 permit applications for the same activity that was being routinely approved, taking dozens, hundreds of hours of time, that we're now, through a general permit, are able to just push those out. If people do things in a certain way, they get approval very quickly. We do maintain some quick review to make sure they're not doing something in an area that's highly sensitive, but it really does make a big difference.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to maybe try some specific examples here, because it talks about giving a general permit to a government subdivision or to the general public. So would one example be, let's say there's a township that has township roads that have to replace culverts because the equipment has increased in size. You've got 60-year-old culverts that may have filled in or they don't handle the water. So instead of issuing a permit for each culvert, you would be issuing a permit to the township?
Mr. Holman?
Members, yes, Representative Hansen, yes, it's absolutely one way. We have issued a number of those, although I should point out that right now we have over 150 general permits, and one of my goals is to reduce that number because that's become administratively burdensome by itself. So right now we do have a general permit out for public review that would cover all townships, cities, counties, and the general public. If you replace a culvert or bridge in a certain way, complying with all the requirements of our regulations and other regulations, including PCA stormwater regulations, you will get quick 5-day turnaround approval.
Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, and that's under existing law, Mr. Holman?
Yes.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Another example, and I'm interested in Section 10 under the aquatic management permit. So let's take an example of a hypothetical lake in Lakeville for curly leaf pondweed. And so you have a city, would a city be receiving then a general permit for the entire lake rather than having individual landowners adjacent to the lake seeking a permit for control of curly leaf pondweed?
Potentially, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Hansen, yes, potentially, yes. We have no history with this yet, so I don't know exactly how it would be done, but I envision that. I also envision, as I mentioned earlier, the one thing I've discovered is that out of the 4,000 aquatic plant management permits issued each year, 3,000 of those are renewals where our staff don't even go out and inspect the sites again. And I'm thinking those would be a good candidate for a general permit, a quick approval, just a quick review, and a sign-off, hopefully eventually online. Somebody could apply for the permit, get the approval online easily and quickly.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking of another example. I think we've all seen the photos of the large milfoil harvesting machines that go on Lake Minnetonka or other places. So right now, those get a permit and they have to renew it, or how does that work compared to what you're proposing for the future?
Mr. Holmuth.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Hansen, yes. Right now, they're issuing a permit that does cover multiple property owners, and I don't see that changing. Although they might, they could conceive, by they I mean the Division of Fish and Wildlife, which I'm not a member of, could conceivably issue a permit for harvesting of milfoil statewide and require a quicker approval. I see it as a way of getting approvals to do that. I think they still want to look at each project individually just to make sure there's not some protected plant in the area that they're working on. But it would set up, instead of having to process each application individually, mail out a new permit each year, it's something that could be done much quicker.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, on the aquatic, I know there's a whole industry that deals with aquatic plant management. Have you engaged them in this discussion about this, or are they aware of this bill, or have you had input in terms of what their thoughts are on the permitting process?
Mr. Holman.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Hansen, no, we have not, because we have nothing specific yet. We're simply asking for the authority to utilize a general permit in the future. There have been no details have been worked out. There would be a public process that would be initiated before any details were worked out.
And then
Representative Hansen.
One final question, Mr. Chair. So, and then on looking at another example, so government subdivision, it could be a watershed district. So you could be, would an example be a new drainage project or a clean out would be, just get a one-time permit, or would you be looking at issuing, would you issue a permit to that watershed district, or would you do a statewide permit for all watershed districts relating to any ditching or clean out, which may or may not involve culverts?
Mr. Hama.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Hansen, that's a possibility. I'll give you, and for example, we already have issued a general permit to Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, which basically allows them to issue a permit for anything we would issue a permit for, trying to reduce multiple permit approvals. That was actually the first general permit the department ever did. I think we started that in about 1996. That's been highly successful and has saved thousands of people significant paperwork.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I'd be a little bit concerned about a one-size-fits-all general state permit, particularly on some water management, because the hydrology up in the northwest is a lot different than the southeast, and a general permit could have some consequences there, particularly where I think Representative Torkelson has a bill about doing watershed-based management or watershed planning, and this, if you have a general permit rather than doing it on a watershed, it seemed to be going cross purposes to where else the other directions were moving.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been sitting here thinking about your saying that you knew lots about the airport thing, and that was a problem with the airport commission. However, that went on for years and years. This wasn't a, you know, little one thing. Oh, the neighborhood came in and said, you're dewatering our lake, and DNR said, oh, airport commission, you can't do that. Why do you think that this language wouldn't have the same kind of consequence in other places that the general permit had there?
Mr. Holmuth.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Wagenius, again, the general permit simply allows a way to approve a project quicker. Even that project required them to submit a proposal to us for review, which they failed to do so in that case. In the case of the airport, we had already studied it significantly. We had set some protection measures in place to protect Lake Nokomis. If there were monitoring wells that they were monitoring, that if their dewatering had any impact on Lake Nokomis, they would have had to shut down immediately. That was all in place. The only thing that went wrong there is they forgot to follow the requirement of their general permit to notify us before they started. In the end, as you well know, nothing did go wrong. The dewatering did not affect Lake Nokomis, and the project was successful from a water management standpoint.
Representative Wagenius.
But it went on for years and years, and DNR didn't step in, and that's why it went on for years and years. So it's still, I look at this, and then tell me how, since you are saying you can issue a general permit without regard to impact, because that's what you're doing, how does that fit with our groundwater statutes that we have now that do say you have to look at impact? I just can't read this law together with what we have on the books.
Mr. Holmuth.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Wagenius, the impact, general permits will not affect our ability to protect water resources. It's simply a way to speed the approvals when there aren't potential problems. All the concerning areas where we've had water resource conflicts, we're not going to allow a general permit to be used for that. People are going to have to apply for an individual permit and go through the long public review process. But there are a number of situations where we're routinely processing applications for the same sort of work that has already been proven or been reviewed and found not to have significant impact. Admittedly, we are occasionally wrong and we go, boy, we wish you wouldn't have issued that permit. But that would happen with or without the general permit.
Representative Fabian.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, just the observation that, yes, Lake Nokomis was not dewatered, but a lot of things changed in that process from the time the neighborhood said, hey, wait a minute, till the time they recommenced construction. And I do not remember at one time that the DNR was standing on the side of the neighborhood. So this is, I think people were afraid of the airport commission. I mean, that DNR was afraid of the commission. Neighborhood wasn't. I mean, that was the difference. So I'm still troubled by this. I get the idea of efficiency, but sometimes we do things that have unintended consequences. And you're basically saying, without regard to impact in the statute, statute, but saying to us, but the rule is still in place that says minimal impact, so that's in effect. That's just not true. So I don't know what we do here, Mr. Chair.
I did not hear a question in that.
It's just an observation. This is.
Thank you for your observation, Representative Wagenius. Are you finished? Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holmuth, particularly interested in Section 4, where you talk about culverts and bridges, and you talk about expediting the process and speeding it up. Can you give me an example of what happens in regards to replacing a culvert, a timeline possibly, and how we're changing that and making it better? Give me an example of what kind of timelines are in place now to get the permit to replace a culvert.
Mr. Holmuth.
Mr. Chair, members, I probably should clarify. We currently do have the authority to issue general permits for those kind of activities. And, in fact, we have one out for public review right now that would be a statewide general permit that would cover replacement of all bridges and culverts of the state. So this bill wouldn't make any change to that requirement. That's the simple answer. This doesn't change that. It does clarify some things. It would require a payment of a fee for utilizing that general permit, which is new.
Follow up, Representative Fadian?
No, thank you.
Thank you. We have no other questions. I do have a question myself, Mr. Holmuth. I see that in here we have a fee for townships, but not other entities of government. Can you explain why townships are paying a fee and state and federal government is not?
Mr. Chair, members, no, I can't. That was set by the legislature. We're simply following current statutory practice, which is not to charge federal and state agencies, but to charge local agencies. The township exemption was something the legislature did a number of years ago to limit township fees to no more than $100. The fee for a bridge project could be up to $1,000, so that provided some financial relief to townships, but not cities and counties.
And to your knowledge, how far back in state history does that discrepancy go?
I think that township language was added a little over 10 years ago.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just kind of a question on the issuance of permits that are going to be for a duration longer than what we currently allow. When whatever entity has to apply for a permit, whether it's for dealing with aquatic plants or something else, how much information is submitted to the agency when that permit application is sent in?
Mr. Holmuth.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative, under a standard permit, and it depends, the permit types vary a lot. They have different statutory requirements. For example, a public waters work permit, which would be like a bridge or excavating in a lake, we need to know exactly what's going to be done, where it is, if it's excavation, where the spoil from the excavation will be placed when the project's done, when it will be done, those kind of details. We would need to know the same sort of thing under a general permit. We need to know exactly what's going to be done, where and when, and there will be conditions in a general permit that will specify what things are allowed. For example, we have fish spawning restrictions. We don't want people stirring up lake beds during fish spawning time, so we set a time limit like between April 1st and June 1st when you're not allowed to do projects that stir up the water, where you could be covering fish eggs with silt by stirring the water up. So there's those kind of restrictions. Did I answer? all your questions.
Representative Faulk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it helps to understand this a little bit better. I guess my concern is that if there's a general permit issued for a duration of an indefinite time period, the amount of information coming back to the agency has a potential to be less in just detail than what you would have if you had to reapply for the permit on an ongoing basis. And so I'm just concerned that when we try to coordinate information, that we may actually have less coordination ability because we have less information coming in to the agency under these revised procedures than we would under current procedures. And I just want to know if that's been something that's been thought about, or if you have some plans to mitigate that, because I do see that there's the significant potential for less information and less coordination, and when we have to try to do as good of a job as we can to coordinate everything, I want to make sure that we're not taking one step forward and two steps back.
Mr. Homa.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The major permits, public waters have a 5-year statutory limit. Right now, if we issue a permit for a new bridge project, it can extend. The permit's good for no more than 5 years. Under the general permit approvals, we typically have a time frame that they're good for. For example, for replacing a bridge or culvert, you get, under a general permit, you get an approval. It's good for one season, as long as you've said. I would envision aquatic plant management permits, if they were covered by a general permit, they would only be good for one season, and then you have to resubmit in case anything has changed. So I think, I mean, there, something could go wrong there, but I think we try to cover that for those possibilities to see if things have changed each time and not let the approvals go on forever.
A follow-up, Representative Faulk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that's the part that makes me nervous, because I heard a lot of words like typically we think we probably wouldn't let this. And so what this bill is doing is essentially removing those protections because it's leaving it completely discretionary. Is that not correct? Where you could have an ongoing permit with an indefinite time period, because this would then allow that. Is that correct?
Mr. Holmuth.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's potentially correct. That's a problem we face without this bill under any permit we issue. For example, appropriate water appropriation permits have no termination date. They potentially go on forever, but things change. The commissioner does have the authority to terminate a permit, to modify it if there are problems that come up. So there are protections built in other parts of the statutes now for when things change, things go wrong.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this bill forward. Would you care to make any final comments?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would just renew my motion to hold over House File 2395 for possible inclusion, and just say that I appreciate the DNR's intent here, trying to carry out the wishes of both the governor and the legislature in trying to, at least in these routine permit applications, make the system work better and more efficiently. Thank you.
Thank you. House File 2395 is held over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Next up, we have House File 2034, Representative Howes. Representative Howes.
We don't move the bill then? You're just laying it over. You don't move it.
We're hearing this for possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. What this bill does, under current law, a tree stand that's left overnight on a WMA before September 16th for bear hunting has to have a person's name and address on it. What we're doing now is allowing them to also just use their driver's license number or the DNR license identification number. So that way a person wouldn't have to put wouldn't say Bill Hilty, because there might be someone that doesn't want Bill Hilty shooting a bear. So this would be a better way to do it.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Meyer, would you care to make any opening remarks?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. We do support the bill. We feel it's a piece we missed last year when we were talking about these stands on WMAs for bear hunting, and it is the same as we require on bear bait station identification right now. So with that in mind, we think it is a good piece of legislation.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. I think you just answered the question, Mr. Meyer, Mr. Chair, that bait registration number is one of the numbers that would be eligible to be on there, right? So that a CO would be able to know that that stand related to that bait.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, we don't issue a bait registration number per se. People are required to put their driver's license number, their DNR identification number, okay, or their name and address on there. So the number you're referring to should be a DNR identification number, which is unique for every individual.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howes, I have had occasions when I wanted to shoot a bear. I'm just looking at the language here, and I'm not sure the language does what your intention is, with which I agree with the intention, but if we're saying you must affix a tag with, one, the person's name and address, two, the license, his driver's license, or isn't that just adding the license? It's not saying you can use that instead of the name and the address.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hilty, I believe with the word or, that means you can use any one of those three. Maybe staff can tell me if I'm wrong or not.
Representative Hilty.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate the opinion of staff on this. It seems to me that the or is giving us a choice only between two and three and not one, two, and three.
Thank you. I would ask Janelle for clarification. Ms. Taylor for clarification, please.
Mr. Chair, members, I would say that with the use of the colon and the semicolons, the or would be any of the three, so you could use any of the three.
Thank you for that. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My thought, since this seems tied to the bait, that it would be advantageous for the DNR person that's checking, that if they use whatever they chose out of these three, and I think that's fine to have the three, that they use the same one on the bait and the stand, so that then it'd be easier to ascertain that they're connected. That's just a thought.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I would totally agree, and I would anticipate that most people would do that, but again, I can't say that with any clarity. So I think most people that I know that do this, they do use that. I think most people are leaning towards their DNR ID number rather than a DL number. So we can look at that clarification in the future if it's needed, but our officers have the ability to take whatever data is there and get the information we need off of it. So,
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howes, I was trying to read through this quickly, and does this have anything to do with requiring a photo ID to bear hunt?
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. I don't recall, but I do know that if I went to my convenience store to get a deer license, a duck license, a pheasant license, I would have to give them my driver's license.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further questions on this bill, any final comments, Representative Howes?
Thank you.
You're welcome. This bill is laid over for possible inclusion.
Next, we'll hear House File 2273, Representative Torkelson's bill dealing with permitting, and it'll be held over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, everyone. House File 2273 is a collection of ideas that is being brought forward as a result of our Reform 2.0 meetings that were held throughout the state. These are ideas that were brought forward by citizens of the state of Minnesota, and basically what they seem to be interested in, what we're interested in, is a government that was more responsive to their needs and actually runs at the speed of business. We have worked to put the ideas we heard forward to the legislature to consider in this bill. We have started conversations with the various agencies that are affected by the ideas in this bill, but they are not necessarily ready for prime time. But as you know around here, if we don't get issues aired, they don't get much attention. So we're bringing these ideas forward. They are legitimate ideas presented to us by the citizens of Minnesota. I'll go through the key provisions, and then we'll have some testifiers. Now, the first provision is establishing a new 60-day minor permit review requirement for the Department of Natural Resources and PCA. In the legislation, the agencies would determine which of these permits are minor permits, and that would be presented to the public. And then, if you're applying for a minor permit, you'd have a 60-day window, and if it's not approved within that time, permit there'd be automatic approval. The next major portion of the bill prohibits the state of Minnesota from adopting more restrictive water standards than are in federal standards. This is going forward, not going backward. It would not change anything that's on the books today. The idea is that if it's good enough for the government, the federal government of the United States, it should be good enough for the state of Minnesota. Next, major portion of the bill credits the fines that are collected by PCA to the general fund instead of the environmental fund. I believe that in the past those were split 50-50, and in fairly recent history they all were shifted over to the environment fund. There's a perception, I'm not saying that the agency is doing anything wrong here, but there certainly is a perception within the populace of the state that there's potential here for the agency to pad its own budget by issuing fines, and it's a similar problem that we sometimes have with some of our enforcement agencies, police and sheriff agencies around the state. This would remove that possible perception and put all those fines into the general fund. Next, a major portion of the bill deals with the MPCA Citizen Board. The Citizens Board was established, I believe, back in the 1960s when the regulation structure was really fairly simple in the state of Minnesota, and running these things past the Citizens Board probably made some sense. Over time, our structure of regulation has become much more robust, and the need for the Citizens Board to look at these applications doesn't seem to be nearly as important, and in fact adds another delay for some permit applications because the Citizens Board does not meet regularly. They're not here 5 days a week. They only meet on an irregular basis, or at least on a limited time frame basis. So sometimes it can delay permit applications for 30 or 60 days just because they have to wait in line to go past the Citizens Board. This would eliminate that problem. It does not eliminate the Citizens Board. They would still serve to inform the commissioner on rulemaking and any other issues that he would request. Final item in the bill is an issue to eliminate duplication between permit applications and environmental assessment worksheets. It just says that you don't have to submit the same information twice, is my understanding. With that, Mr. Chair, I believe we have a Mr. Quillis here from the chamber to testify to some of the items in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Questions? Who do you want to go with, Representative Torkelson?
I was wrong about that. Peter Larson is here to testify to some of the issues in the bill.
Mr. Larson, if you could come forward, and then I think I've got Mr. Kordelka with MPC, with the Pollution Control Agency, and also Molly Peterson from Conservation Minnesota And so if any of you else are thinking about testifying, I'll ask in a few minutes to be sure we have everybody on the list. Welcome, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Larson, Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm not here representing a client today, but I saw the bill, talked with staff, thought I'd take the opportunity just to provide some information for you on why I think this is the PCA board provision in this bill is something that's a good issue for you to talk about. I'm not here to say bad things about the PCA board. I was on the board. I consider many of the people that have served on that board friends. The board now is filled with a lot of good people, and they're some of the most dedicated citizen public servants that there are in government right now. They spend a lot of time on their jobs, and they take it very seriously. But I did want to just talk about a little bit about the history of the board and give you some examples of why you might think about changes. The agency was created in 1967, and if you look on page on 3.14 of the bill, you see the language that creates the board. And what you don't see anymore is the language that was created in 1967, which read, "The Pollution Control Agency, designated as the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, is hereby created. The agency shall consist of 9 members appointed by the governor." So when it was created in 1967, along with a whole bunch of other agencies that were created that year, it was a board. It had an executive director, and that's the way it was created. Now, this was before the Administrative Procedure Act. It was before MIRA and NEPA and MEPA that created Environmental Review. It was before we did sonars for rules. This was created before the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act as we know it now. It was created as a citizens board to do things that we didn't have any laws on, really, so much. In advance of the EPA. And so that's why it was created then, or how it was created then. A few years later, Environmental Review was created on the national level in Minnesota. A few years later, the APA was created, that created the whole administrative law judge process, gave people the opportunity to come before an administrative law judge. And of course, it was created before, like I said, the air permits that we know about, the water permits, RCRA, the Hazardous Waste Regulation, Superfund, all of that. So it was a citizens board to do this. In the 80s, the executive director became a commissioner. So it wasn't until the later 80s that the PCA even had a commissioner. It was still an executive director. In the 90s, a couple significant changes took place, and those are mostly the language you see here. One change that was made was that language that I read was changed from "the agency shall consist of 9 members appointed to the governor." It was changed to say "the agency shall consist of the commissioner and 8 members appointed by the governor." So for the first time in, I think it was 95, the commissioner was on the board. So until then, the commissioner sat next to the board chair. The board chair was elected by the board members and was essentially staff to the agency. If you saw something in law that said the agency should do something, it was the board. I was there during that time. And the thing that we did the next year is we put specifically in law what the agency's authority was informally already. What was going on previously is there were delegations from the board to the commissioner. Everything was the board's responsibility, and there were 3 or 4 three-wing binders around the building that had delegations in them, and they'd be signed every year, and that would be delegating authority to the commissioner from the agency. We at the time thought that it shouldn't just be the people that held those 3-ring binders who should know what the board could do. We thought it was right to put it in statute. So what you see here now in the bill related to the agency responsibilities on page 4 were something that we wrote, and it was essentially, I'm seeing it now deleted, we wrote that so that the public could see what the agency board really did. So this is what was left after the delegation. Specifically, there are written agreements between the board and the commissioner, and this is what was left. So that's where this language came from. And so I wanted to give you that history to understand that this has changed over time, and the citizens board was created in a much different time. And then, again, I'm not here to say bad things about the agency or what they've done over history, but I will say, as a practitioner now, the agency's existence creates a lot of delay. And you have to judge whether that delay is worth it, but it does create a lot of delay. If the DNR has an EIS, they have responsibilities to have public meetings. They have to publish things in the state register. There's comment periods. They have to respond. There's a whole process. If that same project is a PCA EIS, not only are all those comment periods, public meetings, all of those have to take place, but there's probably about four times that there have to be PCA meetings to make decisions. And if you think each one of those might add a couple months and a bunch of staff time, that could add 6 months to a year for the same process, for the same project, mostly because the meetings have to take place. Again, up to you whether that additional process is worth it, but it doesn't happen in any other agency. Same goes for other agencies that have permitting responsibilities, DNR, but also health department responsibilities, hospital permits, hearings, things like that. All the other agencies in state government are able to make these decisions themselves. The PCA has a board, not to say anything again bad about the board, but if you have a board meeting, there's a schedule that you have to go through to get your materials to the agency staff. The agency staff have to prepare materials for the board. They're very diligent. They do a good job. They have to prepare recommendations to the board, and there has to be a public meeting whenever there's a decision that might otherwise just be a commissioner's decision in another agency, and those things cause delay. So those are just things I wanted to mention as a reason that Representative Torkelson is correct to put this on your agenda to think about how this might change.
Questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, you had mentioned as a practitioner you've had experience, and I want to ask you about a different section of the bill as a practitioner, and that's this continual assertion of the potential padding of the agency by doing enforcement. Have you, as a practitioner, both in the agency or on the board or post, have you seen any evidence at all of the agency doing fines to pad the budget?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I didn't intend to come up here and answer that type of question. Whether there's evidence, I can tell you that I have clients who believe that happens. I have a lot of faith in the agency staff to know that they've got responsibilities to issue penalties that are consistent with the violation that occurred. And so I can't say here that I have any evidence, but I can say I hear sometimes that there's that suspicion out there.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, I wanted to ask you about a different section of the bill if you're I just want to ask if you have an opinion on section 2 of the bill where Minnesota would rely on federal standards from here forward to protect the vast water quality and good water quality of our Minnesota's 10,000 lakes. That seems a reach to me, but do you have an opinion on that?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, can I say consistent with the author's opinion that this is something that's worthy of discussion, might not be ready for prime time? Is that allowed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Larson.
Follow up. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just while we're doing committee work here and having discussion, Representative Hansen raised an interesting point about looking for allegations of agents of padding a budget or something like that. And that's a good point for us just to ruminate on for a moment here. Because I know when we deal in other agencies, I've been doing some work with forfeiture, for instance, not only the gang strike force, but some other things. And one of the things that we really struggle with is the appearance of impropriety. And not only the appearance, but the professionals themselves, the awkward and untenable position we often put them in, whenever we have them in a position where it looks like, by doing their sworn duty, they're also padding an agency or their agency benefits. Not them personally, but just the work they're doing. And that's just an awkward spot I wish we would consider, not only in this committee, but in every committee that we're in, whether it's civil law or transportation or anything. Public safety, I deal with that part of the budget, that when we're moving forward with enforcement action, that we don't end up putting these the sworn professionals in an untenable and awkward position that even brings the thought or the hint or the whiff of some sort of impropriety. I know when we on the Legislative Audit Commission, oftentimes the auditor will make recommendations like this. He didn't find any impropriety, but just the recommendation is we may want to realign policies or procedures so that we don't put we don't even allow the tent to exist. So a good question, and it just stimulated that thought. I just wanted to share with the committee.
Good point, Representative Beard. Representative Farkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Beard, for those remarks. Again, I would just reiterate that this section of the bill is not an accusation of wrongdoing in the PCA. It is a revelation that the public perception of this process is one that casts a shadow on the PCA, and changing this would remove that potential.
Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson. I appreciate the conversation about making sure that we have our laws that I tend to trust the PCA and think that they're working for the people of Minnesota. They have certain duties of candor and things that we've discussed in this committee previously. So I'm just curious, Representative Torkelson, well, we've passed a bill that, from many people's perspective, we passed a bill out of this committee. I can't remember if we laid it over or not. I think we passed it out. That could look like a permit application professionals are having impropriety writing their own company's permit application. I'm just curious why, you know, the relationship you see between wanting to make sure there's no appearance of impropriety or appearance of wrongdoing in the agency, but there doesn't seem to be the same lack of concern within the actual businesses themselves. And if you could comment on kind of the both of those things and how you see them related with the, I mean, these bills are two separate bills, but clearly related to permitting and making sure the water and the air and the health of Minnesotans is protected while we also get our permits done efficiently.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Knuth, for that question. You know, that's not my bill. The other bill you're referring to is not my bill, but your interpretation of the effect of that particular bill is different than mine. Certainly, I don't see that would affect public perception in that way. That's more of an inside baseball thing as to who's preparing these lengthy, virtually mountainous applications, and to for a company to be able to do much of that work itself to me is appropriate. To you, it's not. That's the difference we have. That's different than the issue we have here before us with the fines and PCA. There is already certainly a perception within the public that this is an inappropriate structure and that it needs to be changed.
Follow up, Representative New. To this point, Representative Beard.
Thank you, and I'm glad this came up again because I was listening to the discussion the other day, but I was thinking about another bill I had in the next committee, so I didn't really engage on the discussion. But as I remember the bill that Representative Knuth is referring to, and this has come up in the past couple of years, it seems to me that the environmental assessment worksheet is just part of the application process, and that is the facts are the facts. It doesn't matter who fills them in. And to depend on the agency to fill in the blanks and then approve the permit, it could work that way, but it sounds to me like a lot of extra work. To have trained professionals who are certified to do so fill in the blanks doesn't mean that the permit is filled in and applied by the applicant. It just means the blanks are filled in on their permit application. To be very clear, I think that the agency still has to look at the filled-in application and approve the permit. Please correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chair, but I fail to see where having a company hire somebody to fill in the blanks that is familiar with what the agencies are looking for puts them in an untenable position when the agency still has the sworn duty to verify the information and approve the permit or deny the permit. And it would seem to me further that if I was a trained professional who made my living filling in the blanks on environmental worksheets, the only thing I have to make my living on is my integrity and my reliability for getting it right. So if I try to pull a fast one on the agency, that would probably be the last time I would ever do work in this field. I think that's the way I saw that bill, and it just struck me as a common sense move. But if I'm missing something, I'm willing to reconsider.
I think, Representative Beard, you've summed up my analysis of the situation the same. Next, I have Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The observation has been made that the public thinks that the agency may be padding its own wallet. I think that maybe we need to make a distinction between folks who have been fined, who probably do feel that way. But from my listening to constituents and others who are not constituents, I believe the public perception is that the polluters aren't paying their fair share right now. So there are other ways to look at this very same issue.
Representative Torkelson, can I ask you, do you remember when we dealt with this issue, what's the history of the fines in the ethanol industry, and what actually was the situation? Or if we want, I've got Mr. Cadell connects. Maybe he could talk about how the fines changed when the money went to the agency and how much money we're talking about. Was it just a few thousand, or do you remember? Maybe Mr. Kadalka can help us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have that information in front of me, but the fines were in the millions of dollars, and they increased dramatically. It's probably just an issue of timing that the change in statute that put all the fees into the environmental fund happened to happen at the same time that the ethanol industry is expanding dramatically. But again, it's a matter of perception. We saw those fines increase by millions of dollars per year at about the same time that the fines all started going into PCA's environmental fund. I'm not accusing the agency of any wrongdoing. That's not my purpose here. My purpose here is that we clarify this relationship so that there is not that perception among any member of the public, whether they be a permit application or a general citizen. In response to your remarks, Representative Wagenius, I also do not come before you thinking that the agency is not fining enough. Perhaps there are members of the public that think the agency should fine more. I believe there's a process in place where they can come forward as a citizen and identify potential violations of state law, and PCA is required to follow up on those questions that come from the public. I'm ready for Mr. Kadalka if you are.
Thank you. Mr. Kadalka, if you could come forward, identify yourself, and let us hear your comments. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Kirk Kadalka. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And just one quick question. Would you like me to respond to the penalty piece or just work that in the overall?
You know, Mr. Kadalka, I imagine you maybe don't have the specifics, and if I remember having that discussion, you could have somebody from your agency forward that on, and we'll get it to all the members, or if you want to sum it up, you sure can. Otherwise, any general comments you have on this legislation, go ahead at this time.
Chair and committee members, we do have a number of concerns and thoughts about this bill that we'd like to share, and I think I'll just go through them as they appear in the bill, the major five sections of the bill. The first deals with minor permit and amendment 60-day automatic approval. We don't approve a permit. We cannot defend to the public or the EPA with the automatic approval that will put us in the situation where if we're not comfortable or can defend that permit in public or to the EPA, we will have to deny the permit or we'll defer to EPA for review, which will significantly increase the turnaround time on the permit, which is doing the opposite of what we hope to gain. In other states with similar automatic approvals, we've heard stories of environmental agencies asking proposers to waive the deadline at day 59 of a 60-day deadline and then saying if they don't, they will deny the permit. We don't wish to get into those games with the regulated parties here. As the PCA, we believe if it takes a little extra time to get the yes, that extra time is a well spent to get the yes and allow a project to move forward instead of denying it. With a 60-day deadline for the designated minor permits, we would also have to reassign staff to these permits, including renewals, which would put them in front of other priority construction permits. In effect, minor permits would be jumping ahead of more complex permits that do need the extra time and work to help meet the 150-day goal. We believe a better focus would be finding ways to speed up these permits that are near the goal already. Are they good targets for general permits? If we have 5 or 10 permits a similar way we can design a general permit and help speed along that process? Are there things we can process? I think those are the type of things that would be much more beneficial to look at and make changes instead of just having automatic approval at 60 days. Dealing with the water quality standards being no more restrictive than federal standards, we also have strong concerns on this portion. Federal law and regulations establishes a framework which water quality protection through the Clean Water Act. And so what the state does, it designates uses for the waters first and adopts standards to protect those uses. And you've heard us over and over talk about swimmable, drinkable, fishable. Those are our larger overall goals when we're implementing the Federal Clean Water Act, and we create those standards that are needed. And this usually happens in two ways. The first, EPA develops some national criteria that states can use as the building blocks of things to look at when they build their state standard, and we adapt it to local conditions, and this is how many of our standards for toxic pollutants was developed. There was some base background information provided to us by EPA, and then us and every other state then tailored that to the state, to their individual states. In the absence of EPA national criteria or guidance put out on a specific issue, a state or states can develop a standard following EPA's larger umbrella framework. This is how we've been doing it more recently in the last decade, and this is how many states have been doing it, because states are in the driver's seat and it reflects the state's conditions, their needs, and their values. State adoption of standards recognizes the place-based nature of water quality protection. Different areas, different characteristics support different uses because they behave differently. For example, lakes in Iowa and South Dakota don't act the same way as in Minnesota. They're different geographically, they're different geologically, and they're different biologically. In adopting standards, Minnesota doesn't go beyond the federal system that's created through the Clean Water Act at this point. Unfortunately, we believe this provision is going to actually be problematic because it will introduce significant confusion to the process in addition for lawsuits. Addition of lawsuits will just end up taking longer for protections that are needed in the public request to be put into place. Dealing with the penalty revenues deposited to the general fund, penalties collected by the MPCA cannot be used until the legislature appropriates. So while they go into the environment fund, we cannot touch them until they are given to the agency. So even if we wanted to, which we do not, and PCA can't use these penalties as a fundraiser, some folks have believed. Money appropriated by the legislature from the environmental fund is also controlled by our fiscal staff, not the compliance or enforcement folks that set penalty amounts. There's that division created there to make sure there is no padding of any funds, as has been commented on. Also, this policy has a long-term fiscal ramification. This change will reduce the environmental fund by approximately $3.2 million each biennium, and this would leave the environmental fund with just $1.5 million left for the fund balance. And this is significant because for the first time since fiscal year 2007, the fund is not projecting a deficit in the next biennium. This is a fund that's had a number of difficulties, and as a result, we have been forced to limit the amount of remediation and brownfield cleanup programs that we're done because of the lack of brownfield cleanup programs that we're done because of the lack of money. This money is usually then transferred to the remediation fund that helps get land and areas back onto the tax rolls and into economic development and creating jobs. Through the hard work of previous legislators and our internal decision making on how we are offering early retirement, reducing activities, we've been able to keep it from going into the red. This provision, I think, will put us back into that same area. We understand the perception issue. We did not ask for the legislative change in 2009. However, if we change where the money goes from the environmental fund to the general fund, will that make the perception go away? That difference between the environmental fund and the general fund is really legislative insider baseball. To the folks out on the street, it makes no difference. I think they'll see it either way. Given the perception issue and the fact penalties are not viewed as a stable revenue source, we're willing to explore the issue, but we need to solve all concerns, not just the perception issue. And just real quick, I want to note, I do have some information on the revenue history of before and after the change, and I will provide this to the committee. During the last 5 years, we have averaged $1.6 million in penalties to the agency environmental fund. The agency itself, that's a very small portion of the agency's budget. In 07, it was a little shy of $1.6 million. In 08, it was $1.5 million. In 09, it was $1.5 million. Then the change occurred. Prior to that, there was a formula that part of it went in the environmental fund and the other part went in the general fund. In 2010, it did jump to $2.1 million, but then in 11, it went back to the average of $1.6 million. So at this point, there was not a change in between there. We've been pretty consistent about that $1.6 million, that the penalty amounts. It's just who are assigned those penalties seems to change, but the overall amount seems to stay consistent. The fourth item in the bill is the removal of the MPCA's board involvement in permitting an environmental review. Looking at the data, the number of projects that go before the board number in about 5 to 6 a year. And our larger universe at the MPCA is 3,000 to 5,000 permits a year. So we're looking at a very, very, very small sample size here that we're talking about going to the board. So the benefits are potentially very small. As mentioned before, the very complex of the complex and controversial and high public interest ones are that come before the board. And as mentioned by the former Commissioner Larson, there were changes in the early 90s that removed the board from involvement in routine permits, which was a good change, and that's why the large majority of permits are done by the commissioner and the rest of the agency. While there are public comment opportunities in the permitting environmental review process, we found citizens value the ability to take their issues before a board of peers instead of the commissioner, which in some cases helps increase the acceptance of decisions, which is good for the regulated party and everyone involved. In addition, the board has helped us mediate a number of controversial and difficult projects. Excel Dairy was a situation of enforcement issue dealing with a permit in northwest Minnesota where the board's involvement had a great deal in resolving that issue. So given the complexity and depth of the issues involved, and I've just highlighted a very small amount there, and other questions of how the PCA board relates to the UQB and other environmental bodies, we believe there's need for a lengthier consideration of this issue, and the governor, through his executive order, has put together that form already. The UQB will be reviewing environmental governance to look at these type of things. Right now, there's the MPCA board, the UQB board, the Bowser board, the Clean Water Council, the LaSard-SAMS Council, LCCMR, PUC, a number of budget oversight committees in DNR. We have a large number of governance groups out there already. We really believe instead of looking at one individually, we need to look at the whole system and see what changes may be needed. And for that, I think there needs to be a much larger, lengthier debate given all the factors that play into it. The last issue is the duplicative information in environmental review and permitting. During the environmental review and permitting process, we do use that information provided for one aspect for the other, so we don't ask for new additional information to be created or given to us again. That's already being done. In fact, language very similar to what's being proposed in this bill is already in current law. Just further up that same statute, the subdivision 2AG, is language that says essentially the same thing. The wording is just a little different. It's already the practice of the agency. But it does beg the larger question of where permitting environmental review overlap. And again, this is where we have a form and a platform provided by the governor's executive order where we'll be reviewing, and the UQB will be reviewing environmental review over the next 9 months, looking at these questions, where there are those overlaps. And even the larger concept, is environmental review accomplishing what we meant to do when it first was developed? How is the regulatory system permitting that? A standard that evolved over time and may have made parts redundant? And then where are there gaps and needs that aren't being met by the original environmental review legislation and permitting? Again, a much more complex, in-depth discussion that the EQB has provided a form for, and we'll have recommendations on November 15th of this year. that'll conclude my comments at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Kudelka. What we're going to do, we're going to take the public comment now because I've got a long list of people that have questions for you, and I'm thinking it's going to take the rest of the time. So, Representative Torkelson, we'll go to you first when we bring Mr. Kudelka back. But I know I have Ms. Peterson wants to speak. Is there anybody else? If you could come down now, Ms. Peterson from Conservation Minnesota. And Mike Robertson will speak on behalf of the chamber. Let's do you first, Ms. Peterson. If you could identify yourself and who you represent and keep your comments to 2 minutes, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Molly Peterson, Government Affairs Director for Conservation Minnesota, and we are expressing just a couple concerns with the bill as in its current form. And our primary concern is the section that prohibits Minnesota from adopting standards that are more restrictive than federal water quality standards. And our concern is that under the Clean Water Act, specifically states are charged with setting specific water quality criteria appropriate for their waters and developing pollution control programs to meet them. So in many cases, the federal standards that we're not supposed to surpass actually don't exist. And so it's not really clear what would happen under this bill if that were the case. For example, the federal government doesn't have a uniform phosphorus standard that it considers a minimum or a benchmark for the country. Minnesota put its own phosphorus standard in place for lakes. It's in the process right now of reviewing and putting one in place for rivers. But under this bill, it's not clear if we would be even allowed to implement the standard for rivers. If there's no federal standard, then, you know, is that number zero, and then would anything that the state would try to implement be more restrictive than zero? So I think that we just want to continue to, we appreciate Representative Torkelson starting the conversation about this, but we would appreciate the opportunity to work on it a little bit more and see what we can do to alleviate some of those concerns. Finally, we have some concerns with diverting the penalties from the Environmental Fund back to the General Fund. Every year, Conservation Minnesota does an analysis of the agency budget for the Pollution Control Agency, the DNR, the Department of Ag, and Bowser. And every year, we show just a continued downward trend of funding going into those agencies. Currently, the penalties and fines account for only 3% of the Environmental Fund revenue, and so this is just a small portion. We don't under, you know, while there might be a perception out there, this just doesn't seem to be enough of a dollar amount that it would be worthy of diluting into the general fund and having it go for other purposes. So those are our concerns, and we continue to look forward to working with Representative Torkelson, and thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you, Ms. Peterson. Questions? Thank you. And if I'm not mistaken, you brought up the level of funding for the environment. I believe our fiscal analyst, Mr. Reynolds, prepared a document, and I'll get it sent out to everybody that actually shows funding levels for the environment and what's happened over the last few decades. And I think it'll be enlightening for those of us that like to see more money sent to the environment. It's important to know that the legislature over the last couple of decades has made decisions a lot along the lines of taking things from the general fund and putting them in dedicated accounts. More and more people have said, you know, we'd like our money that we pay in a fee to go to a dedicated account. Unfortunately, when they talk about the environmental fund being funding being eroded, they only talk about the general fund. And it's interesting, if we put it all together, Mr. Reinhold's document actually shows a different picture than many of us are led to believe. I think you would see that the environment total funding has done very well, even when you take out the exception. Folks often talk about the legacy funding and how that skews things. It's interesting to look at that with the legacy funding not included. So I think it'll be good information for everybody, and we can have a discussion about that at some point. It might be a good thing to talk about after deadlines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We look forward to seeing Mr. Reinholz's
And we'll get it forwarded to the group too, so that they can all see it. It was good information. He just gave it to us in the last few days. Mr. Robertson, I think you're going to pinch hit for Mr. Quillis. So if you could come down, and again, Mr. Robertson, if you could keep your comments to 2 minutes, that would be good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Robertson, representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Tony is, I was going to say detained in another committee, but I'll say he's occupied in another committee. Detained didn't sound like the appropriate word. The Chamber would like to thank Representative Torkelson for bringing this bill forward today. We enthusiastically look to work with anyone who has ideas on streamlining and making the environmental permitting and review process more efficient. A lot of the ideas that are in this bill have been discussed. We have been working with agency staff from the very beginning of the consideration of House File 1, Representative Fabian's bill of last year, and his bill that's moving forward now. And there are a number of ideas in this bill that are worthy of continued discussion. I would especially mention the issue of 60 days. And as we have looked at this issue over the past months and talking about it with the PCA, we would like to find ways to have some other dividing lines on what the goals would be for permits. Right now, under the House File 1 that passed last year, we have a goal of 150 days. And as you heard in the report from the PCA, they are meeting the 150 days on 99% of the permits. And I think that creates a perception that everything is great and that we don't need to do anything more to make the system more efficient. We think there are ways, you know, the majority of those permits that are issued within 99 days are permits that are issued within weeks. Very simple permits, general permits that are issued within less than 30 days. So we want to work with the agency on some ideas on how we can maybe set some other goals that for specific areas of permitting. And we've had some, it's a very difficult conversation, as Mr. Kudelka said, about minor permits and the amount of resources necessary to deal with minor permits, the priority on dealing with permits for new or expanded economic facilities. So we're looking forward to working on these issues. It's an ongoing process, and it's a lot of work, and we look forward to working with Representative Torkelson, members of the committee, and the PCA on these issues.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Robertson, I was kind of surprised there when you said Mr. Quillis is in the Occupy Committee. I mean, he might have switched.
I said he was occupied.
Occupied. Oh, okay. Occupied.
Not the Occupy
Committee. That would have been quite a change. But my question is back on the federal standard thing. I'm thinking from my concern here is that you turn the floor into the ceiling. And I, personal example, when I was in the Ag Department, we had an incident where, with the pesticide law, you have a federal floor, and Minnesota has the authority to go higher. And there was an incident where we were getting states crossing the border, and we found that a pesticide applicator license in Mississippi just required that somebody show up at a meeting and write an X on a sheet of paper to have their training, whereas we required a closed book exam, and this has been the law for 20 years, 20, 30 years in Minnesota. And so what happens is when you go to the federal standard, then you accept the X on the sheet of paper rather than having the closed book exam, the continuing education training. And we know that the federal government can move very slowly at times when there is, even when there's an incident or an accident, and this was such of a case. So as the chamber, I would think that you'd want our state to be a shining star and to not be bound to the requirements of Mississippi or Alabama, but to actually have the protection that I think our citizens expect. How do you deal with that issue?
Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with the analysis of Mr. Kudelka and Ms. Peterson about the way water quality standards are established. There are no federal ambient water quality standards. Minnesota adopts water quality standards, as Mr. Kudelka said, based on some federal criteria. So the issue in each specific instance is, what is some scientific criteria that the EPA may have in some document somewhere versus what are the conditions within a specific water body in Minnesota? And the first instance where that becomes an issue is when the PCA is adopting water quality standards in rule, which they do do a triennial review periodically. It doesn't happen to be every 3 years, but they will make changes in the rules, and those are the standards that EPA approves, and they become the EPA standards in Minnesota because they're adopted locally. So I think in any given situation, there may be disagreement between parties about which criteria with regard to a particular parameter may be appropriate. But in the end, Mr. Kudelka is right that there are no national regulations that apply to ambient waters. Those are adopted by each state who have delegated authority from EPA.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I appreciate Mr. Robertson for telling us about how standards really operate and that understanding. But as we move forward on this particular piece of water quality standards, no more restrictive than federal standards, if it's rewritten to meet the outline that you just suggested, here would be what I would worry about. And I want to see if you would share this concern, that the agriculture community might be very happy to have water quality standards no stricter than the federal government. On the other hand, our tourism community might feel extremely differently about that. I mean, I think our tourism community would say, we want to be able to say, come to Minnesota and go fishing. We don't want to say, come to Minnesota and go fishing, but don't eat the fish. I think our tourism industry would like to say, come to Minnesota and go swimming, not come to Minnesota and go swimming, but don't go to don't let your kids go in this list of lakes. And I think our tourism industry, a realtor would like to say, come to Minnesota and buy a cottage, but for sure don't buy anything on this lake because the habitat is all gone because we don't have shoreline rules. So, I mean, I see a real, even in the business community, while I can see one part of the business community that would very much like to limit any rulemaking for waters, there is another part of our business community that is doing well because we are working on protecting our waters. Do you not see that same conflict that I see?
Mr. Robertson, if you want to give a quick comment.
Yeah, quick comment. The reason for this concern is, and we've talked about this before because it was addressed in House File 1 last year, the reason for this concern is the competitive nature and the global economy and all of those issues that we've talked about ad nauseum in terms of competition for development within our state. This was addressed in House File 1 last year. There was a provision in that bill which said when the agency is rulemaking and establishing standards by rule, that they have to review the standards in the states that surround Minnesota and the EPA's standards. It doesn't say that they have to be no more stringent than, but they have to analyze and make a statement as to why they need to be more stringent if that is the determination in the rulemaking. So it is an issue that's been around for a long time. It was addressed in House File 1. This has been another way to discuss and address the issue, and you know, as discussed earlier, there are some legal problems with how you could implement something in the words that are in the bill right now.
Thank you. We'll bring back Mr. Kordelka. I don't see anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against
Chairman.
The bill. Representative Torkelson, I think you were ready to make some comments about this additional permitting reform you're interested in working on. I wanted to just make a comment beforehand. Members, I've met, I believe, three different times over the last year with three dairy farmers that are dealing with a permit issue, very unique, larger dairy farmers that actually, Representative Torkelson will get the more technical things that I screw up on this issue, but basically these folks have good-sized dairies. There's three of them that have these engines in their facility that create renewable energy by capturing the methane gas off of it's an enclosed system, so you don't have the fumes from the cow manure. You actually capture that gas. They use that gas to run what looks like a big diesel engine, but it's powered by cow manure, which is a pretty cool thing, you know, when you think about renewable energy and, wow, is that ever cool? They get to do that. And then, unlike when I was coming home on Sunday, I noticed off on the edge of a farm field that had had the manure spread on it on kind of a slope, and it was snow-covered, and I looked at it and thought, boy, too bad they don't do what these guys do. They actually inject the manure through a hose system. They don't even transfer the manure to manure spreaders or a tank, which some folks do a tank system, which is a great thing. It's a lot better than the open manure spreader. They use a series of hoses and underground piping and such to inject it into the soil to minimize the smell. Well, if you can imagine, we have had three meetings with these folks in them dealing with the permit issue on the emissions from the engine. They actually are at the frustration level that they're ready to just burn the methane gas out of a flame, and there's nothing wrong with that. They can just burn it, and it's okay. Then that would eliminate their problem. Or they can go all the way to the extreme, unfortunately, of what some of the other things are going on. They are so frustrated with this process, and what it is they have three of these engines, and we are being treated completely different than the rest of the nation. I think there's 44 of these engines across the country that are doing this. One of them actually moved their calves to Texas. Members, do you know what's going on? We have hay all over northern Minnesota sitting in the field still because we had such plentiful hay crop here. They're actually trucking it down the freeway to haul it to Texas so they have hay. We've created a system where a dairy farmer in Minnesota, it's advantageous for them to ship calves and raise them in Texas when the hay's got to come from Minnesota. If you think we don't need permitting reform, what's wrong with this picture where a good Minnesota dairy is sending their calves to Texas and we're hauling the hay from Minnesota to Texas and they have an engine on their farm to create renewable energy, and we're arguing with them over the permit on an engine that is licensed and applicable and used in this country? 41 of them in other states other than Minnesota are being treated different. And you say, well, you could work this out. We've actually had three meetings, at least two of them with the commissioner, over the last like year on this issue. It's unbelievable. And for us to say, well, we don't need any permitting reform, I don't know what I screwed up on simplifying this system. I know, Representative Torkelson, you're familiar with it, and you can correct if I said anything wrong. We can't have a dairy farmer in Minnesota shipping their calves to Texas when they're in the middle of a drought and look me in the face and say, we're happy. It works economically. Something's upside down. We got hay sitting in northern Minnesota. The calves are here. How can it make sense to truck calves and hay to Texas when they're in a drought? Let's at least fix some permitting thing. Maybe we can't totally fix the tax structure different from us to Texas, but you know, we got plants here, cheese plants and milk plants that have additional capacity. This is just one example there's other ones, Representative Fabian, guys in the wood stove business that are having challenges and stuff. We got to fix some things, members, and I know it's hard. We want to protect the water, but I'm telling you, when I look out driving home on Sunday and seeing somebody spreading manure on a field, completely legal. They do it. They do it all around our neighborhoods. They're spreading manure. That's okay. These are guys that are burning the gas of the manure that would just be going up in the air, and we're hassling them over the monitoring of the air emissions of that engine for the next 3 years and arguing if it should be $60,000 a year to monitor the air emissions of the engine. This is real, members. I am not making it up. Representative Torkelson and I sat in the last meeting, and it was like, oh, my God, you can't be serious. This is real. It's the kind of things that we need to address. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for those remarks. I think that's an issue that deserves more discussion, and we will do that hopefully on another day. And I would just say it's a prime example of where different regulation sets of regulations and different agencies get at cross purposes with each other within government, and that conflict within government is then saddled upon our businessmen and prevents them from doing the work that they want to do. Here we have folks that want to burn methane to create generate electricity, which is something we certainly support, and then we're getting in the way of that effort with other with another set of regulations that just it's just ridiculous, and that falls on the businessman, whereas these issues should be worked out within government, in my opinion. That's an aside. I would like to just cover a couple items with Mr. Kudelka quickly. First, regarding the minor permit proposition in this bill, I understand your discomfort with the automatic approval, but could you comment on just the idea of having a structure that involves minor permits?
Before I go to you, Mr. Kudelka, I had Quam, Draskowski, and Scott. Unfortunately, they're not going to get to answer their questions of Mr. Kudelka. This will come back before us members when it's incorporated into an omnibus permitting bill. Mr. Kudelka will be speaking to that then. But if you could catch Mr. Kudelka, if it's something that you'd like to ask him about after the committee, I would appreciate that. Unless at this time any one of you have a pressing short comment you wanted to make. It was first Quam.
Two quick. One is the I was also concerned about 3.5 when Ms. Peterson was bringing up the federal, and then I realized that we addressed things that weren't federally addressed by the wild rice discussion and bill last year, and then I've got some details on this. I'll hit Padelka.
Thank later. You. Representative Draskowski, thank you for passing. Representative Scott, thank you. Mr. Kudelka, to Representative Torkelson's question.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the automatic approval is a very large concern of ours. The creation of the minor permit system, there's still a situation where we as an agency have made the conscious decision to prioritize construction or other decisions need to be made by the agency on whether to move forward with a permit or not for construction and creating jobs. The way this is written, we would have to jump renewals for whatever is deemed minor permits into the queue before some of these more complex priority construction job permits. So we do have some concerns with that. A company, when their permit is has gone beyond the 5 years and has expired, if as long as they have a reapplication into the process, that company can still operate under the previous provisions in the permit, and those protections for the environment are still there. So the company can keep operating, environment protections are still there. We have decided to make sure we can put our resources towards those that create jobs that we are holding off on renewals. This would change that even without the 60-day automatic approval.
Thank you. Representative Beard, do you want to move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes of the last meeting and urge their adoption.
Discussion of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Meeting's adjourned.